We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Philip has just lost the respect of the Youth League football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
Welcome to the Solid Verbal.
The Solid Verbal.
Come after me! I'm a man! I'm 40!
I've heard so many players say, well, I want to be happy. You want to be happy for a day? Eat a steak.
It's that woo woo!
And now, Dan and Ty.
Welcome back to the Solid Verbal, boys and girls. My name is Ty Hildenbrand. Joining me, as always, quarantined over there in New York City, the one and only Dan Rubenstein. Sir, how are you?
Clean hands, full nuggets. I guess I'm full of nuggets. I'm not full nuggets. But unlike Notre Dame, can't lose.
Can't lose, huh?
Yeah, that's true. I'm very excited for this show. I am extremely excited for the show. I talked to our pal Adam Amin from ESPN, who is doing his best over there in Chicago, somebody who's usually on the road. He wants to record like 17 of these with us.
Okay.
So I'm excited for this one.
Very good. Well, this could be the start of something special. As you know, as most listening know, something of an odd circumstance in the world at the moment with a global pandemic, most of us trapped indoors looking for something to do. And we also don't know if there's going to be a college football season. I don't want to look too far in the future, but it is something that is very much on the table. We'll cross that bridge when we come to it. But in the meantime, we are caught in this awkward spot where we want to talk college football because people listen for college football, but we just don't have college football to discuss.
Right.
So perhaps you've been following along on our nightly Instagram live feeds as we've gathered for 15 to 20 minutes to talk about whatever moves us. But we came up with the idea to do more of what we did last offseason, which was go back, watch an old iconic game and talk about it. Do the post-mortem, do the oral history, whatever have you. That's what we're going to start doing, perhaps a little bit more of. And we decided that we would start with the illustrious Bush push game of 2005, USC beating Notre Dame in Notre Dame Stadium, 34-31.
It's important, and I think we're going to try to do this as often as possible, to have an emotional and professional stakeholder on the show. Maybe one, maybe none, maybe both. Today, we're starting with both because Ty, you as a longtime Notre Dame fan and attendee,
yes,
of this game, you're an emotional stakeholder. And Yogi Roth was an offensive assistant for USC at this time, was sitting like 14 inches from Lane Kiffin, co-offensive coordinator during this game. And he's going to join us later on in the show, I think, for some equal time, Ty.
Equal time? No, that's fair. That's fair. So he was in the booth, like you said, yeah, 14 inches from Lane Kiffin. And I was in section 106, row 3, seat 27. I checked my ticket. I still have it laminated over at Mama H's house because it was such a meaningful event for me.
I imagine it had to have been. Let's start. I don't know if you have any housekeeping you want to get into, but I have so many thoughts about this game in 2005 and the early 2000s with Notre Dame and USC and beyond. I'd like to start getting into the context.
The context. Okay. Well, yeah. Before we get into that context, the context okay. here, subscribe to the show. We are the Solid Verbal. I'm Ty. He's Dan. Follow along on Twitter, on Instagram, and on Facebook. If you want to continue the conversation, Lord knows there are plenty of our ballers who are holed up at the moment.
Yeah.
Want to talk college football. Just want to be amongst friends. Want to feel that connectedness, Dan.
Mm-hmm.
Going out to solidverbal.reddit.com. That is the subreddit that is commandeered by our good friend, Peter Hoffman. So,
yes.
With that being said, Dan, give me the lay of the land here in 2005. Again, Notre Dame, USC, one of the big matchups, perhaps of all time. Certainly from a rivalry standpoint, it is. But in 2005, what were the atmospherics that kind of built up to this matchup?
Dateline, 2005. So this was a top 10 matchup. So first and foremost, USC came into this game with a lot more momentum, national attention as the number one team in America than Notre Dame did, who sort of crept into the top 10. They started the season as an others receiving vote, right? This was not a hype Notre Dame team.
No.
In terms of expectations in year one of the Charlie Weiss era.
Correct.
Whereas USC demolishes Oklahoma the year before to win the national championship. They are considered a national champion the year before after their Rose Bowl win, where they're named the AP number one, but not the BCS number one. That went to LSU. The end of 2002 was very promising. There was, you know, an exciting Carson Palmer to Matt Leinart, even though Leinart wasn't super well regarded. There was that transition. The USC was deep in a pretty terrible era in the Paul Hackett era, and then they hire Pete Carroll, and slowly but surely, the recruiting is incredible. The results slowly but surely reflect the recruiting grades and team rankings, whatever. Whereas Notre Dame is an unexpected top 10 team and could not have treated you worse between the end of the 2000 season and arguably even into the early part of the 2005 season, which includes going down 38-17 in South Bend to Michigan State, Brady Quinn putting the team on his back, willing them back down 21 to tie the game with 2 minutes left, goes to overtime.
And then they lose.
And then they lose. And that comes also during a time in which they beat the number three team in the country, I think, a couple weeks later, if my memory serves, in Michigan. No, they beat Michigan.
Michigan was the week before. Michigan was the week before.
They beat number three Michigan the week before, after beating the ranked Pitt Panthers the week before that. So they're on the national radar. They lose to unranked Michigan State at home, but right the ship. Before USC, Brady Quinn has experience as the starting quarterback for Notre Dame, but it's year one in the Charlie Weiss system as well. And I want to know what the road to, oh crap, Notre Dame might be good again, look like for you between in the early aughts. That's what it would be called.
Sure.
What is that road? What does that roller coaster emotionally look like to you?
Well, emotionally, again, as a Notre Dame fan between us, I was very uncertain about this.
Right.
Ty Willingham, the era that he kind of ushered in, had a really good first year. I didn't really think it was totally valid. Like, it just felt like so much of that team was built on defense. The offense kind of stank. And they were able to do it. They were able to win a bunch of games. But it never felt like this was a legitimate contending kind of team.
Right.
And okay. So obviously the next 2 years of Willingham didn't go well. To now step into the Charlie Weiss era, I didn't quite know what to think. Now, I was a proponent of them hiring Charlie Weiss. I liked the move.
Sure.
And, you know, it was a breath of fresh air. This is a guy who's got some offense on his resume. Presumably he's going to come in there. He's going to reboot the offense. And he did, as we'll talk about, I'm sure, reboot the offense. This was a top 10 offense throughout the course of the 2005 season. But honestly, I sort of didn't know how to feel. This is a program that had been down for a while. They won a national championship in the late 80s. They were really good in the early to mid 90s under Lou Holtz. But
great run, yeah.
But towards the end of the millennium, as we got into the aughts, as you say, yeah, the program was not quite where you'd want it to be as a fan. So I was just very uncertain about the whole thing.
Yeah, the Bob Davie era was, I was trying to think of a nickname for him, and the best thing I could come up with was Bullish Bob, because those Notre Dame teams, they were bullish. They
sure.
were always in bowls, but they were bullish. You skipped over one amazing nugget of that era. I mean, there are many amazing nuggets in that era as somebody who enjoys college football chaos. Notre Dame hired George O'Leary to replace Bob Davie in 2001,
For a moment. He had a cup of coffee.
There were some discrepancies on his resume.
Right.
And he never wound up coaching at Notre Dame. So then they moved on to Ty Willingham, who won his first two games as the Irish head coach without Notre Dame scoring an offensive touchdown.
Facts only.
Which, you know, it's, if you can do it, good on you. So then they hired Charlie Weiss, who it seems like this is a pro move. Literally, this is hiring a pro.
Yeah.
A guy from the Patriots who had worked with Tom Brady and Super Bowl winner and is a Notre Dame guy. And this is Notre Dame stepping up to the plate to stop fooling around with guys who are not to the caliber of what Notre Dame perceives itself to be. And pretty early on, it looks promising.
It looked extremely promising. And they had this stud quarterback in Brady Quinn, as I'm sure we'll discuss here as we go a little bit further into the game.
Yeah.
They had big targets for him. They had a serviceable running game that they actually leaned on very heavily.
Yes.
Throughout the course of the year, they ran the ball about 40 times. In this game that we're going to talk about, they ran it 52 times. So, you know, Charlie Weiss, I thought, from a very high level, did a pretty good job balancing the offense. He knew how to try and use the personnel that he had to great effect. And so that was good. That aspect of it was good. He did come in and made a very positive impact. The ability to sustain that success moving forward is ultimately what did him in. He had a very successful campaign in year one, diminishing returns thereafter, was never quite able to build in the trenches, never quite able to maintain on the defensive side or build up on the defensive side the way we would have hoped. And that ultimately led to his undoing. But at least out of the chute for Charlie Weiss in year one, it was very promising.
Yeah, and we'll get to the postscript. We will, I promise. What I would also like to add, because we talked about Notre Dame early on that season, USC starts the season number one. They end the regular season number one. That's the USC-Texas year, of course, where they are 1-2 all season long. They drop 63 in a huge win against Hawaii in the islands, and then just absolutely demolish Arkansas. They had a home-and-home, I believe, with Arkansas.
Killed
dropped
them.
A buck 20 combined.
Just killed them. Yeah.
And I believe that 2006 Arkansas team was pretty good. That was a Darren McFadden, Felix Jones, Peyton Hillis team. Good defense, too. They fell down early to Oregon, but came back and stomped the Ducks in Eugene. I was trying to remember if I was at that game. For some reason, I think I was.
You probably were, right?
Well, I had graduated that summer, so I would have been returning to Eugene. I think I might have been. And a huge comeback. They go down 18 at halftime to ASU in Tempe. USC wins. They're 4-0 on the road in their first six games, which is a pretty incredible split. But they come back and they win that game 38-28. And this is Reggie Bush and Lendale White really coming into their own. And then later on in the Arizona game, the following week after ASU, and this is the week before Notre Dame, they eventually run away from an Arizona team. Shout out Richard Kovalchuk.
That's right.
Shout out that Arizona team. But so it wasn't, there were some scares. There were some moments of hesitation, I think, from USC, especially early on in games. But ultimately, their talent and their ability and the depth that they had built up won out. And this was number one against number nine. And obviously, your favorite part of the lead up to this game that week was a very specific story about Notre Dame's preparation.
Notre Dame's preparation. Yeah.
They grew the hell out of what, Ty?
The grass, Dan. So let me provide further context. I was at this game at the time. This is 2005. If you want to know more about what I was doing in 2005, go back and listen to the history of the Solid Verbal Show. But my connection to actually get tickets to this game is among dabbling with some early rendition of what is now known as podcasting. I was also doing a lot of live streaming, audio streaming, not Twitch or YouTube or anything like that. I was helping some others in the college football community get some of their own streams up and running. And among them was a good friend of mine from Notre Dame who was able to hook me up with tickets.
Nice.
Did look at me like I had two heads when I brought my friend Kurt along, who's a diehard USC fan, wore his Keith Rivers jersey to the game. But we were there, we were in attendance, and we come walking into this beautiful stadium, Notre Dame Stadium. You look down on the field and it looks like a cow pasture. It looks as if they have not cut this in 3 to 4 weeks.
Like a Penn State tailgate. Isn't that what the outside of Beaver Stadium looks like? Aren't there multiple pastures?
There are multiple pastures, to say the least.
Yeah.
So it's like, what the hell is this? And like so much in the Charlie Weiss era, and we talked about this a little bit on the Instagram feed.
Yeah.
Like so much of the Charlie Weiss era, it was like, okay, this could be clever or this could be really overthought.
Right.
And you just don't know where to come down on it. That in many ways was kind of a synopsis of the Weiss era. But they grow the grass out. It's very apparent as you're watching the broadcast. I didn't hear if they referenced it. I'm sure they did throughout the broadcast that we watched. But certainly in person, it was flowing. It was every bit as flowing as Jeff Samarja's hair. And, obviously it didn't have that much of an impact, but it was very noticeable and is the kind of thing that you saw. And it was like, all right, like I need to kick the tires a little bit more on who made this call, why they decided to do it, and what they thought they were going to gain out of doing this.
Were you drunk? How much were you tailgating? This is probably you're 2 years out of college?
2 years? No, I wasn't at all.
You weren't at all drunk. No. You were focused.
I was very focused.
Like a fighter the night before a huge fight.
No, I was laser focused. And actually, in my younger and more immature days, quite nervous about this game.
Okay.
So I didn't want to upset the tummy too much.
Okay, fair enough. And there is something important, and I don't know what your stance was, and we'll get into this when we talk about the very beginning of the game itself, which we'll momentarily. There was some, I think it's just among Notre Dame fans, more so than it is college football fans. But early on in the broadcast, when Notre Dame runs out of the tunnel, there was shock, awe, bewilderment, excitement, borderline horniness.
Yeah.
About the color of Notre Dame's jerseys.
Oh, no. Don't start with this.
Was that a thing the week leading up? Were there message board rumors? Because I'm positive message boards existed in 2005.
Well,
were there murmurings?
Charlie Weiss had notably said that he wasn't going to do the green jersey thing.
Right.
And then he decided, Rope-a-dope. As you find out on the broadcast, he decided 2 weeks before the game that it was something that they wanted to do. And as Tom Hammond had to point out, it was his duty to point out as the lead commentator on the game, Notre Dame at that point was something like 0-3 wearing the jerseys, but 3-0 against USC.
Right.
They had lost their last three overall, but had won their last three against USC wearing the green jersey. I'll have you know that when I saw them come out of the tunnel, I didn't know in the buildup to this game that they were going to go green jerseys.
Oh, okay. There were no rumors that you saw. Okay.
In my younger, again, more immature days, I'm in the stands. I'm watching this. Everyone's all jazzed up for Notre Dame to run out of the tunnel. They run out of the tunnel. I am audibly screaming, no, from section 103, wherever I was, because they had the green jerseys on. And I knew, at least I felt that it was some sort of bad omen. Now, you wouldn't know that to hear Tom Hammond. Tom Hammond went crazy like Susan Waldman went crazy.
That was my comparison. Yeah, he went from 12 to 6.
When Roger Clemens signed with the Yankees, the way Susan Waldman reacted, that was what Tom Hammond did. And even to watch it back now, keep in mind, I had never actually seen this broadcast. I saw the game live, never had the heart to go back and watch it in its totality. All these cheap little jokes like, oh, those green jerseys look so good in HD. Whatever, Tom. Whatever.
I don't think my stream was in HD. I don't think my YouTube upload that I watched was in HD, which I'm actually glad you mentioned, because I don't know when all of the networks broadcast all of their games or most of their games or some of their games in HD, but it wasn't long before this.
No. And hey, listen back to the broadcast.
Yeah.
I'll tell you one thing that doesn't hold up over time. Old tech jokes. Tech jokes don't hold up because tech changes from year to year.
Yeah.
So in this broadcast, especially, a lot of quips about high definition television, like Pat Hayden telling Tom Hammond, I think you even sound better in HD, Tom. Stuff like that.
To give you an even better idea of what 2005 was like on screen, by the way, I haven't seen any of the top 10 movies. that weekend, The Fog, Wallace and Gromit, and Elizabethtown were your top three. I know A History of Violence people still watch. I think a wiener involved in that one. Great top 10, music-wise, Billboard-wise. Gold Digger, number one song
good
in the country.
Good tune.
Sugar, We're Going Down, number 10.
Oh, wow.
You got some David Banner. You've got two Mariah Carey songs, and obviously Nickelback's Photograph checking in at number three.
Sure.
All of the top TV shows this week in America feel like they're still on or were on 3 years ago. There's a couple CSIs, Grey's Anatomy, there's Survivor, 60 Minutes, Two and a Half Men, I don't think is on anymore, but was somewhat recently, I think. Law and Order, the Astros beat the, or got demolished by the White Sox, right? Avian flu was a thing. The NHL returned after their lockout. And the Colbert Report started. This is a long time ago. It doesn't feel so long because Matt Leinart and Brady Quinn and Reggie Bush are still in our lives, still on our 4K TVs. It's a long ass time ago, Ty.
Can I talk about something else?
Please.
Pertaining to the broadcast?
Yeah.
I want to talk about the old Notre Dame on NBC intro score.
Ty, even before that, though, do you know what the first words of the broadcast I watched were?
What's that?
In like the most stereotypical Notre Dame, like tropey nonsense. The year was 1926. I'm not kidding.
I think that we watched the same one.
Not an exaggeration.
Yeah.
They went through the history of it, and when they're taking the train out to LA,
right.
It was, the year is 1926.
Newt Rockne's wife told him to do it. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, God. I watched it too.
Bless. Yeah.
I want the oral history on how NBC came up with that old intro score. Because, again, not to go too much back to the live feed that people probably can't access anymore, but we did do a chat on Instagram where we talked about the early days of Notre Dame on NBC and how one of the complaints from non-Notre Dame fans, even some Notre Dame fans, was that it was a little too homery.
Like watching the game on notredame.edu.
The Notre Dame Network.
Yeah.
And it's like, they didn't want to be too over the top, but they wanted to get Notre Dame fans fired up.
Sure.
So they just borrowed like 3.5 notes from the Notre Dame fight song. And they blended it in with the rest of the music. So it wasn't too over the top. But then it's like they listen back and they're like, we need to make people feel dangerous again. We need to make this older fan base feel dangerous.
Yeah.
And it's at that point, Dan, that I can only imagine they made some guitarist's career and said, can you add a little bit of Dream Theater there? Can you give me just a little bit of a guitar riff?
Maybe a little California Dreams, Ty. Maybe they borrowed the TNBC band.
Just a little bit of, just a little riff for me here. And that's how you get this. Wait for it. Just wait a little longer. Here we go.
Oh,
God!
Way up the fretboard.
I gotta play it one more time. Just listen to this.
Please.
Some guy got really into this. Gyrations, probably, I'm sure.
It's probably the John Tesh, Nick Saban guitar.
It could be. Here we go. Listen to that.
It has to be.
They don't use that anymore. They can't. It's somewhere in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Dan.
Hold on. Do we think this is Tesh?
I'm not.
I'm being 100%
Tesh.
Serious.
It could be Tesh.
Well, he did NBA on NBC. Entertainment Tonight was syndicated.
No.
He definitely has an NBC Sports connection with musical intros.
True.
I think there's at least a 35% chance it's Tesh and Tesh's band.
There is a non-zero chance that's Tesh.
Yeah. I think it's a robust chance. I'm looking this up now. But yeah, it's killer.
They really went for it with that intro. And I totally forgot about it, to say the least. But it set the stage for every Notre Dame game. And this is a big one. To watch it back, I mean, everyone was fired up. Tom Hammond sounded a little more pre-programmed than usual, which was a welcome addition. It's been a while since I've had Tom Hammond in my life. And, you know, we're going to talk a little bit more about the game here momentarily when we bring Yogi on.
Right.
He's actually part of the coaching element of this game, so he can give us a little bit more detail than maybe I could from the stands or you could from your television. But certainly a great game, an awesome fourth quarter. 34-31 was the final here. USC needed some heroics in the final 2 minutes to pull this one out. A long pass to Dwayne Jarrett, which happened right in front of me. The Bush push, obviously, a controversial moment in the history of college football, but nonetheless, one that extended USC's winning streak. At the time, it was 27, extended to 28. Mm-hmm. And we know where it played out from there. Obviously, played out in Pasadena, one of the all-time great college football championship games, just college football games in general, between USC and Texas. Texas won that game to win the national championship.
Ty, I have breaking news.
Breaking news!
It was Tesh!
What?
I confirmed it.
What?
John Tesh did college football on NBC, parenthetically, Notre Dame football.
Oh, God, that cheapens it.
Oh, I think it makes it so much better.
That was freaking Tesh. Are you kidding me?
That means almost assuredly that was Nick Saban guitarist.
Damn.
Hell yeah.
That is some research here. That's off-season research, Dan.
That's Wikipedia, baby.
That was Tesh.
Yeah, that was Tesh.
Get the hell out. Okay.
Yeah, now we know.
Breaking news. That's perfect.
No problem.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
All right, so do you want to get into this actual game?
Let's talk about the actual football.
Let's talk about the actual football game, Dan. Went back. I was able to find something on YouTube. It sounds like it was the same clip. And I came away, I think, impressed by what I saw from Notre Dame.
And this, you have a surprised tone to your voice.
Well, I do, because Notre Dame's defense was, I think, the big liability going into this football game.
Mm-hmm.
They were certainly not the best against the run. They were even worse against the pass. And that was a problem against USC, because they got Reggie Bush, sure, who was in the midst of his own Heisman campaign. You've got Matt Leinart, who already won one. And it's, you got to pick your poison. Notre Dame, I thought, did a really good job with its front seven, getting some pressure against a really good offensive line.
Mm-hmm.
Had a lot of future pros in that offensive line. They did a good job bringing pressure against Matt Leinart. They did enough to kind of keep the offense in it. And when the offense had the ball, I actually thought their game plan was pretty clever. They tried to milk the crap out of the clock.
Yeah, they did.
Overwhelmed USC when it came to time of possession. They just tried to keep that SC offense off the field. And as a result, the SC offense didn't get nearly their normal amount of offense in terms of yardage. I think they were, 601 in average offensive output.
Right.
They didn't get anywhere close to that in this football game because Notre Dame just kept them off the field. So at least to that extent, I felt like, even though I wasn't privy to any coaching stuff, I felt as if the game plan was effective and they were able to keep themselves in the game until, the last however many seconds.
Yeah, USC, I don't think they didn't get to 500 yards, but they were still pretty efficient thanks to some bigger plays. And they both came out pretty slow, which is understandable in a huge game. The flow was pretty uneven, I would say, watching this game. Notre Dame started out really cold, but they had a couple chunk plays. Probably the best offensive play of the game in terms of just steely confidence, Brady Quinn to Jeff Samardzija for a touchdown, sort of a jump ball, the perfect read, a great throw, a great catch. But in terms of what Notre Dame was actually able to do, this was not an efficient Notre Dame offense.
No.
They just sort of had a game plan to nickel and dime and hope for the best. And they sort of had a number of points. I guess both quarterbacks tried to give the game away. They both had two bad interceptions, one of which was, I think, one or both of Brady Quinn's were tipped. It was a tipped flea flicker, I believe.
Yeah, right.
That Keith Rivers ended up intercepting, sort of floating down in the middle of the field. But I came away surprised that both quarterbacks were more underwhelming than I remembered.
Yeah.
I loved Matt Leinart, and I remember being so impressed with Brady Quinn, thinking, oh, both the guys are sure thing pro success stories.
Yep, yeah.
And it turns out, and I guess smartly for both of these teams, they just sort of got the ball to some talented guys and made smart decisions and won close games more often than not. USC blowing out more teams, certainly the better program around this time. But for what Notre Dame did, for them to be in this game, I thought was all on the back of Brady Quinn, good and bad.
Yeah.
Like he and the offensive line, I would say, they struggled with USC pressure pretty much the entire game until the end. When USC started sending extra guys, he really took a lot of abuse. But he was also the guy who gutted out essentially the comeback after a nothing second half offensively from Notre Dame in terms of scoring points.
No, it's 100% true. And I believe it was either Pat Hayden or Tom Hammond. One of the announcers referred to him as all day tough Brady Quinn.
Right.
And you're absolutely right. I mean, it so much of this came down to him. He was tight early in that game.
Mm-hmm.
And his deep ball left a lot to be desired. But as the game wore on, and certainly on that last drive when he scampered in for a touchdown, he was 3 of 3, made some big throws. I wonder why, in hindsight, they didn't just lob every pass up to Jeff Samardzija.
I was wondering the same thing, Ty.
You know, like Jeff Samardzija, watching back, I guess I didn't appreciate him in the moment the way I feel like I did yesterday when I watched the game. Like, he was so good. He was so much bigger than anyone trying to cover him. He caught every ball with his hands, and he was just a beast to try and man up. They had such a matchup disadvantage, not just with him, but with Maurice Stovall, who was also 6'5", wasn't nearly the caliber of the receiver.
But had
Jeff Samardzija
that season, though.
But had really big games, had a good year. And also Anthony Fasano. Anthony Fasano, NFL tight end, also 6'5", had a huge fumble late in the third quarter in this game, which, had he not fumbled and had Notre Dame gotten some points, perhaps this outcome would have been a little bit different. But between those three guys, like, there aren't a whole lot of college programs, maybe not even USC, who can cover three high-caliber players who are 6'5".
The counterpoint is, if the philosophy is milk the clock, if you're throwing incomplete passes and they're not, they're not moving the ball before those incomplete passes, you're giving the ball back pretty quickly. And that USC offensive line, even with as good as the Notre Dame defensive front looked in that game and pretty much all year, this is a good Notre Dame defense. You're changing the tenor of that game. So I would have thought that they would have challenged USC, especially because outside of Darnell Bing, this was not a particularly good USC secondary, you know, all things considered, compared to, I guess, other USC secondaries during this era. But this was, as we saw Vince Young do late in the year, as we saw a number of quarterbacks do this season, they were vulnerable. And the problem was Brady Quinn's line, I don't think, could protect him long enough.
No.
To go through progressions and go downfield, because even sending five, there was, you know, USC was putting out corner blitzes. They were rushing a linebacker. They were doing, you know, double A gap blitzes. He just didn't have the time. So I get it, I suppose, from the Notre Dame perspective, but I was watching this game and I was like, Notre Dame has a single dude on offense. All due respect to a gutty Brady Quinn, What's the running back? They had two running backs.
Darius Walker and Travis Thomas.
Yeah. And respect to Maurice Stovall and Anthony Fasano, there were good players across this Notre Dame offense. The one dude was Samardzija. And I was surprised they didn't more successfully get the ball to him. And he had a big game.
Yeah, oh yeah.
But
really big game.
I was surprised that Notre Dame went with so many, you know, jumbo packages, essentially putting 7-8 guys on the line of scrimmage and trying to gut out 3-4 yards at a time.
And let's be clear, Samardzija had 15 touchdowns that year and over 1,200 yards receiving. Could have very easily been an NFL receiver. Instead, went to play baseball where he made $122 million. So he's
pretty good.
You could say he chose wisely from a financial standpoint. And yeah, it's been a good pitcher there. We won't go into his baseball accolades, but that
sure.
On the rewatch, it was a lot of short, high percentage stuff. They were trying to keep the clock moving. It was clear that that was part of the game plan, maybe not the primary game plan, but a part of it for sure. I would have loved to have seen a little bit more Jeff Samardzija, just lob it up to him. Even if it's not the best throw, he was good enough to go up and get it.
Two-time Biletnikoff finalist, Jeff Samardzija. Yeah. Brady Quinn with an unbelievable ability to throw a pass nearly straight up when throwing. He threw a fade from like the 12-yard line that may have gone 45 yards up.
Directly up.
The air.
Yeah.
Directly up.
Like a Harrier jet directly up.
It went like the ability for him to put as little touch on the ball as possible was impressive in its own way. Who are the dudes on the other side of the ball, either for Notre Dame on defense or for USC in general, to you?
Well, do we want to talk about Reggie Bush?
I think we should talk about Reggie Bush.
It is so clear on the rewatch that the best player on the field is Reggie Bush. And I know, like, if you're listening to this now, you're thinking, well, obviously he's Reggie Bush. But to go back and rewatch this, Reggie Bush is so good in this football game. It's abundantly clear that there's no one else on the field, even remotely close.
The fact that USC was thought of to be creative on offense with the way they used Reggie Bush, and you actually watch the game with 20/20 eyes, and there's just a lot of, I guess, but why not much more?
Yeah.
Why not much more Reggie Bush? Why aren't there all sorts of little flare screens? Why isn't he going out for routes with linebackers on him all the time, or safeties, whatever? Why isn't he, you know, just a threat on every play? And they ran, USC themselves ran a lot of 6, 7, 8 guys on the line and with the fullback. And Matt Leinart made an all-time terrible throw to what he thought was a wide open wheel route to a fullback. And through just the easiest interception perhaps in the history of Notre Dame football. But it was surprising. They had a reverse for him late. They had some screen action for him, but it was so abundantly clear that just this should have been Jeff Samardzija versus Reggie Bush. And I think it missed the mark on what it could have been, but that's 20/20 eyes, Ty. That is 100% 20/20 eyes. On defense, Darnell Bing was everywhere for USC.
Keith Rivers had a good, really good game. I think he had a recovered fumble. He had the interception.
There was a defensive lineman. I think he was number 98. I don't have the roster in front of me for Notre Dame, who had the sack on Matt Leinart after being knocked down by an offensive lineman. Do you know what I'm talking about?
The
two plays before the Dwayne Jarrett play in the game. He sacks Matt Leinart on like USC's 9-yard line.
Is that Derek Landry, maybe?
It could have been. I don't know. I don't have the roster.
I'll go back and check.
Yeah, yeah. That was a dude play. That was a dude effort that should have won the game, essentially, for Notre Dame. Unfortunately, for Irish fans, it didn't. But I came away surprised that I also, again, thought Matt Leinart and Brady Quinn were better. And I know there were other games where they were definitely better. And I know they were both playing against tough defenses. And I know that they're not playing in modern versions of the spread. They did not have any arm talent.
Trevor Laws.
There you go.
Trevor Laws.
They missed, both of these teams missed a lot that was given to them. That was there. Be it drops, be it overthrows. I was surprised that two guys who were taken in the first round, who were, for the most part, rightfully lauded, they missed a lot in this game.
Well, and hey, both teams really. Both teams
I'm saying both. Leinart and Brady Quinn missed.
Both teams had plenty of chances to win that football game. And, you know, only one did, but both of them for sure, it was out there. There were a bunch of opportunities that were left on the table. And it's part of what makes this game one of the greats, because it was so dead even. The whole way through, it was dead even. It was back and forth right down to the final wire.
You're just a mess in the stands, right?
An absolute mess in the stands. And
yeah.
Not to mention that when you're in the stands at a football game, Notre Dame Stadium, at least at the time, was not the easiest stadium in which to stay informed, because they didn't have, like, the electronics were just not on the level of other stadiums.
Number 44,
right. It's not like Beaver Stadium where you've got a massive board that you can look at.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
No, it's Notre Dame Stadium. You still have that old crappy scoreboard. You have no idea what's going on. You can't see. We didn't have the greatest seats in the world. They were good. Right. We were in the stadium. We were happy to be there, but we didn't know that final sequence. We had no idea what was going on. It wasn't until after the fact that we saw the highlights, we actually understood the sequencing and how things broke down. But no, you just didn't know. And because of that, it was very emotional in the stands. A lot of high fives, a lot of curse words being yelled out, even in Notre Dame Stadium. Yes. And truly one of the greatest experiences I've had just as a sports fan, being in that stadium, trying to decipher what the hell is going on.
Should also mention Tom Zbikowski, absolute dude.
Played out of his mind in that game. He ran back a punt.
Yep.
He was...
got beat a couple times, but never for touchdown. Like, he was beat, I think, by Steve Smith on a play-action play, but they were able to make the play. It was not a house call.
Just knew the right angles.
Yeah.
Played really gritty in that football game. Ambrose Wooden.
Wes Welker type. Gritty Wes Welker.
Gritty Wes Welker. No.
Yeah.
Ambrose Wooden, who was the corner who I believe got beat by Dwayne Jarrett on that notable pass play on the final sequence there, had a bunch of big plays leading up to that moment, you know, where he would track a guy down from behind and prevent a scoring play or something like that.
They stuck with the receivers really well. I don't know if that was unexpected, but the Notre Dame secondary, I thought, did an admirable job.
105th in passing yards allowed per game, that defense. Mm. And to go toe-to-toe with USC the way they did, USC had big chunk plays, as you said earlier, and they certainly were the better team, the more talented team out there. But Notre Dame's defense did just enough. They did enough to kind of keep that game close. And if not for that final incredible drive by USC, they would have won.
Yeah. And if not for the final drive for Notre Dame, they would have lost bigger, because that was winning time. I don't know if it was a Brady Quinn fourth quarter comeback type thing mentality in his head. But the drive he put together, I think he had like three or four passes that went for over 15 yards leading up to the fourth quarter that final drive for Notre Dame. And then it was just stick after stick after stick. And there was the one play where he was running to his left and sort of threw it at the last second, lobbed it over a USC player to complete a first down. That was an incredible play. There was a lot of what ifs in the game, as there are in many big games and even little games. I came away, I think, just impressed with what that fourth quarter was. That overshadowed the rest of everything to me. I had, and I've voiced some negative thoughts about some of the stalled drives and sort of what seems through 2020 eyes, obtuse play calling, and just architecture of the offense, which isn't fair to that time. But I got in the rewatch, and we can talk about the broadcast itself here. I was 86% as excited as I was when I didn't know what was going to happen. And that's a testament to how great that ending was.
It was a really good ending. Yeah. The fourth quarter is up there. Up there with some of the best.
Does that game in some part of your brain remain in protest because of technically a legal push at the end of the game?
No. No, it doesn't, because it, for as close as the game was, and
at
for
the
as
time illegal. Yeah.
Yeah. And sure, for as many chances as I felt Notre Dame had, it didn't have to come down to that play.
No.
They had opportunities. I mentioned the Fasano fumble, but there were others. There were other plays that were out there, and Notre Dame wasn't able to take advantage. So, it shouldn't have come down to that play to begin with. And let's be honest, Notre Dame was ninth going into that game. USC was number one and riding a huge winning streak, 27 games.
Yeah.
Anything just to be close to me felt like gravy. I didn't expect that Notre Dame was going to win that game. So I think it was a little easier to reconcile just for me as a fan, again, knowing that this was still probably a much more talented team. It didn't feel good knowing that Notre Dame lost to him, but at the same time, it wasn't in protest. I still felt like USC was the better of the two teams.
I did like that Notre Dame, there is a section of Notre Dame's playbook that was probably labeled different kinds of sneaks for different situations.
Well, Brady Quinn ran the ball 13 times in this game.
He did. They had a third and four from their own 20, and they did like a quick sneak. And then they went for it on fourth and one from their own like 24 for the first down. Ballsy stupid. Worked.
Right. It
ballsy
worked.
Ballsy stupid. They were running Brady Quinn on a number of third downs. And I don't know if that was a lack of confidence in his arm or the offensive line or receivers getting open quickly enough against the USC defense. But yeah, he had like this weird fake slant, and then he would take off. He would sort of tuck, and that converted like a third and five.
Yeah.
There was a definite element to this game plan that involved Brady Quinn tucks it or pushes the line forward as best as he can.
Yeah, like maybe they saw something where the line was overcommitting and they tried to
right.
take advantage of that in short yardage situations. I don't know, but for sure, like there, just with the running game in general, again, Notre Dame ran the ball 52 times here, 2.9 yards per carry, so
yeah.
not at all efficient. But if you watched each play in a vacuum,
mm-hmm.
and if you were not able to connect it to the larger game plan, which again, I think was to try and drain the clock against a better
sure.
offense, keep them off
yeah.
the field, you could have convinced yourself that this was a video game where Charlie Weiss was just trying to run the ball as much as possible.
Yes.
You know, like it didn't feel all that balanced, at least not early on in this game, watching the way that he called the game.
It was a Sim City of a game plan built entirely out of modest residential housing.
Exactly. I think.
Yeah. And this, the adage that Bill Connolly at ESPN, just in terms of what metric wins you the most games, and you know, people point to turnover margin, and that's certainly one of the best ways to win a game, by winning the turnover margin, but generating and stopping explosive plays is the metric that he has found most likely determines the outcome of a game, and
yeah.
USC won that metric.
So what was your general takeaway from watching this game now 15 years later?
It both played out faster and slower because of no attempt at tempo and running as many plays as humanly possible, not throwing as many passes as probably either program would if it were 2016, 17, 18, 19, 20. The number of jumbo sets that both of these teams ran, considering they had quarterbacks who were very, very successful with very, very good receivers. I was surprised at how, I mean, don't drink every time I say 20-20 eyes, but how sort of old school, for as good as these programs were on offense and became on offense, how 3 yards in a cloud of dust they were willing to accept. That was weird to me.
Yeah.
But also huddles. Huddles are weird to me now.
Well, it's funny you say that, because my takeaway was that this great USC team, this iconic USC team,
yeah,
would get bombed by Clemson.
Oh,
would
yeah.
get bombed by Joe Burrow and LSU, or Tua and Alabama.
Like 100%.
It is such a different era, and it's really in the not so distant past.
No, and in this, listen, it's in the last 15 years, the ability and the ability to scout and recruit and find guys online and watch way more tape than usual and better quality.
Totally different universe.
So the talent, and this was interesting to me because I went back and looked at the recruiting classes, at least however much you believe in total depth of talent having to do with team success. USC was a lot more talented than Notre Dame. Near the end of the Ty Willingham era and that first Charlie Weiss recruiting class, this was a program finishing with classes in the 20s, 30s, whatever, as USC was putting together top three, four, top one, if you believe certain recruiting sites, recruiting classes. This was a much more talented USC team than Notre Dame's was. And so with that talent, if we are going to push that team into the modern era, I am positive this USC team could compete with anybody. But what they look like schematically on offense, you're like, no, this isn't working. This is, you're maybe getting the best of what Stanford has been,
yeah.
but not what the recent best of Clemson, Alabama, LSU has been.
Fair enough. So general takeaways on the broadcast quickly before we get to our guest.
I thought it was fine. B plus. I didn't take exception with any of what the announcers had to say most of the time. I got a lot of replay, which I was relieved about. I didn't know if we were going to see multiple angles.
Yeah, by the way, interesting factoid.
Yeah.
That interested more than just Tom Hammond in this game. Given the rules at the time, the visiting team got to choose whether or not they'd have replay at their disposal. And
oh, interesting.
Pete Carroll decided against it.
Oh, I was saying just TV broadcast.
No, no, I know, replay, but I'm saying from the actual game.
Oh, wow.
In the standpoint of on field, yeah. Okay. Pete Carroll chose not to have replay.
I thought Tom Hammond was good enough. I thought Pat Hayden was good enough. I thought the angles were good enough for the most part. And I just missed the theme song, Desperately and Forever Now.
It's funny you should say that. Just wait for it. Just wait for the Tesh. Here it is, right here.
Oh,
wow.
It's 100% Tesh.
Crazy.
Ah. If only the Notre Dame band had the foresight to just play that song at halftime and wheel out a guitar soloist. No, I was pleasantly surprised, even though it was 64% too homery. I was still pleasantly surprised with the broadcast itself.
I thought they did a good job. Yeah. I really did. Okay. Not a huge fan of Tom Hammond, have never been, but I thought he did a really good job in this game. And Pat Hayden was better than I remembered. You know, was doing a really good job up there as well. So one of those games that for sure will carry on in memory forever, because not just for the fourth quarter, but the circumstances around the game, just a ton of fun the whole way
through.
Can we do
one of those postscripts, what happened after, for everybody, like at the end of The Sandlot or a bunch of movies? Like, yeah, Benny the Jet Rodriguez went on to set records for the Dodgers and winked at the guy calling the game in the booth who still wears his old fishing
cap. This is part of why the Fox pregame show is a little weird for me. Because it's Brady Quinn, Reggie Bush, and Matt Leinart all in the same set.
True. They are all friends. They are all each other's godparents for their children. That's not true, to my knowledge. But it is strange. But it's good. It's good that you get this sort of full circle-ness to everything. Spoiler, Charlie Weiss did not work out at Notre Dame.
No.
Didn't work out. Reggie Bush's legacy at USC is complicated. Brady Quinn and Matt Leinart didn't necessarily work out as NFL quarterbacks. But USC is still chasing the ghost of Pete Carroll. And that's something. Notre Dame, in the long term, I don't know if you would say that Notre Dame has won, but they've been a more stable program since the end of the Charlie Weiss era. Right?
Yeah. No, 100%.
Which is very strange to say, considering what was going on into this game, the 5 years going into this game, where it's just this slow rise for USC and just trying to pick their pets' heads off the ground at Notre Dame.
Yeah.
Should mention, just because I like my nuggies, the former Notre Dame athletic director, Kevin White.
Yep.
His history at Notre Dame, as far as I can tell, I don't know if he hired Bob Davie, but he gave Bob Davie an extension.
Yes.
He then tried to hire George O'Leary. Didn't work out. Hired Ty Willingham. Hired Charlie Weiss. Gave Charlie Weiss an extension that lasted... let's call it 6 years after he was let go from the university, where he would collect this incredible check, I think, every Christmas. And now he is the athletic director, I believe, at Duke. So he is still a working athletic director. And Ty Willingham, even though he made way for Charlie Weiss, went to Washington. And I assume that all worked out really well. He got a vote of confidence from then Washington president Mark Emmert. So everything, I'm sure, is fine in Seattle. No, Notre Dame, in terms of stability, they probably came out on top, but they have not come close to what USC was able to accomplish in this era. All right, Ty. And now, in the interest of equal time, we spent a lot of time in the intro of this show talking about your emotions as a Notre Dame fan, the roller coaster of, I would say, some disappointment in the years leading up to USC Notre Dame 2005. The thing is, with USC leading up to this game, it was gravy. It was good times all around. And since we have you as an emotional stakeholder, Ty, I think we'd need a professional stakeholder on the other side of things for equal time. Yogi Roth, who wore a number of hats for USC at this time. In today's parlance, I guess he would have been an offensive analyst. He was an offensive assistant. He was in the booth next to Lane Kiffin, who was calling the game for the USC offense.
He got a cameo on the broadcast. We saw him. We were texting it back and forth.
We did see him very briefly in the booth on the broadcast in the second half. You have to look closely for a 9-year-old Yogi Roth in the booth. Yogi Roth, of course, now of the Pac-12 Network. Look up all of his podcasts, The Yogi Roth Show. He does a Pac-12 podcast with Ted Robinson of the Pac-12 Network. And they're doing a Zoom show while we're all at home. Yogi, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thank you for bringing me back down memory lane, man. I appreciate it.
Of course. So I want to get into this right now. This was a huge game. You were a part of a number of huge games with USC. What do you remember about even just the season leading up to mid-October, South Bend, Indiana?
Well, it was my first year coaching, Dan. So to me, I was like, well, I'll just coach forever and never lose a game. You know, and Pete, I had known since I was 19, and he had become, you know, the biggest influence in my life outside of my parents at a young age. And he would always pull me and his son, who's now the run game coordinator for the Seahawks, Brandon, aside and say, guys, this is not really what coaching is. And we were like, yeah, whatever. Like, we're in LA, Hollywood, undefeated, going for a third straight natty. I just came off of like a career at Pittsburgh, and life was epic, you know? And clearly that wasn't necessarily the case as you look back on that now, knowing what we all know about the profession. But that's what I remember. It was just so special. It was so dynamic. It was unlike anything I'd ever felt. You know, I just played for 4 years in college at a high level, and SC was like a different stratosphere. And what I had come to learn is that it remains that. Like, nothing in college football has ever been like SC because of Los Angeles and because of Pete. You know, Bama wins, Clemson wins, but they're doing it in the middle of nowhere compared to when we were doing it. So it was epic, man. And then you add in Notre Dame, you add in Charlie Weiss, you add in all the drama around the rivalry. And even Pete would say his first year, he hyped up the drama so much to the team. And then he realized, like, kids at SC, the players, they don't really care. Like, they care more about the UCLA game than they do Notre Dame because they grow up with all those kids. So he was like, let me just treat it as another game versus everything that, of course, was building around it.
What are you doing behind the scenes at this point? I mean, I know you're working with the offense. I know you're working closely with the coordinators, but what are your specific responsibilities? Is it watching film? Is it working with the guys on the practice field? Is it helping to scout ahead of time? What is it that you were doing?
Well, it was kind of fun because it was the beginning of my career there. It was the first of 4 straight years that I spent at SC. And by the end, I'd end up writing Coach Carroll's book. And in the beginning, I was just trying to survive, you know, literally. Like, you think, and I tell this to athletes all the time when they think about coaching, we think we know the game when we're playing, you know. And I was like the smart receiver because I wasn't the biggest or the fastest, but I knew nothing compared to what you need to know when you join a coaching staff. So there I was, call it 6 months in at the time, and you're just doing everything that Lane and Sark said. Remember, this was the transition of offensive coordinators, right? Norm Chow left to the Titans, and in came these two 30-somethings, you know, Sarkifian, right? It was their nickname, at least in the LA Times at the time. And I was trying to do anything I could for them. So I was always a week ahead in terms of advanced scouting. So you'd break down 3 to 5 games of Notre Dame. You know, the previous week we were playing ASU and we had to gear up for this one. So I was already ahead of the curve a little bit. And then I was the guy who drew every play. So if I wasn't moving, I literally have the call sheet from that game, but it's in the bottom of a box right now, and our playbook. And my job was to draw up every play for the offensive players and the staff with all the notes in it. And what Sark and Lane did, what was brilliant, is by me drawing those plays literally thousands of times, it forced me to learn it and gain some mastery around it. So I did that. And then my responsibility was the actual call sheet. So the thing that you'd see, you know, Sark holding on the sideline when you watch the game back, or what Lane's looking at, that was me typing until 2 or 3 every morning. You know, little changes, subtle changes, you know, the wristband that Leinart would be wearing, I would make and build all of the administrative elements, I guess you would say, on the offensive side.
So, Yogi, you did some of the advanced work, I'm sure, on Notre Dame. How much of what the coaches saw from your advanced scouting did they sort of put into practice? Like, what did they see in that advanced scouting that they sought to exploit on game day?
Yeah, well, the advanced scouting, the thing that it does is that it just basically, the phrase I like to use is chunks information. So it says, hey, majority on the first down of a possession or first and 10 situation, second and 10, they're playing this on defense. Third and whether it's 1-3, 4-6, et cetera, they're playing this. These are the blitzes they like to bring. This is when they like to bring them. This is the front. And what it allows us to do is when you click into next game mode, which is Sunday, usually Sunday afternoon, you kind of have an idea. So then when you're drawing cards or you're trying to just send out, like back in the day, it would be like one piece of paper we would give to the quarterbacks. They'd come up Sunday night and it'd be like, hey, these are the initial thoughts we have for first and second down in the pass game. What do you think, Matt, John David, you know, Mark, I think it was a freshman at the time, Mark Sanchez. So that's what it does. Kind of gives them a little head start. But what I had learned is that coaches are so anal that, like, GAs and young coaches, we do all this work, but it kind of, like, it matters, but it kind of doesn't, because coaches just trust themselves, especially play callers. So they kind of do it all themselves. So Sunday nights, I would sit in Sark's office and sit next to him as he kind of redid and double checked everything to make sure that if I called something to nerd out, I know you guys like to, an over front, right? Mm-hmm. Which would be like the nose tackle over one side of the center and the interior defensive lineman over a side of the guard. Well, if they saw him moved 6 inches, they might call it something different. So they were always kind of double checking those numbers to make sure they were right. So I think it just gave them an idea. But I don't think any coach in the country is going to count on or trust like a 22, 23 year old kid to give them any sort of advanced game plan, to be honest.
Well, what was the general vibe among the team going into this Notre Dame game? I know you said Pete Carroll tried to treat it more like any other game. But, you know, this is a program that came into the Notre Dame game with a 27-game winning streak. There was a lot of confidence there. But generally speaking, was it a confident vibe? I mean, they had a bit of a scare against Arizona State that I suppose could have changed the confidence level. But where was the team at going into this game?
Yeah, you know, confidence was, I still think what Pete did there around our confidence and how we built it was so different than anybody else in the history of college football, at least in my 20 years around this craft. And I say that because we didn't gain confidence based on how we played on Saturday. And that was like ingrained, manipulated into the brains of coaches and definitely the influential players, which was, you're going to gain your confidence practice on Monday. And Pete was so good at, you know, you guys have heard about it, like the days of the week, you know, tell the truth Monday, competition Tuesday, no repeat or no turnover Wednesday and no repeat Thursday and perfect Friday. And that was basically what you just did. And you were so ingrained and engrossed in that, that you didn't really think about like, oh man, like we got Notre Dame this week, or we got to go to Sun Devil Stadium this week. Like we didn't really care. And it was interesting because here we are as coaches. And I know specifically for me, I grew up a Notre Dame fan. All I want to do is go there. I went to Pitt because Notre Dame turned me down, like as sad as that is to say. So I'm here thinking about this rivalry, like, hey, Dwayne, Steve, like Matt, like you kidding me? Like you guys aren't juiced up like I am. And they were just like this. And you got to give them credit for that. And that is all Pete. That was all the psychology. Now, with that said, all the coaches, we knew what was at stake. The players knew what was at stake in terms of if you lose, you know, at that era of college football, you were kind of outside looking in at a national championship opportunity. So guys knew that and they felt that, but we knew that we escaped the previous week, but we also knew that we really hurt ourselves in that game. And you go back and watch it. The first half was super hot. Nobody was prepared. It was the hottest I'd ever been in my life, you know, coming from Pennsylvania. We weren't prepared for that, but we came out and just kicked the daylights out of them in the second half. And we knew that we were the most talented team in the country. And if we just executed, we would win and we would dominate teams. And we knew it wouldn't be easy. We'd get everybody's best shot, but our confidence never was never really a question. Like even when we lost to Texas that year, like confidence was still through the roof. And that's all about Pete of trying to just, he really just made everybody realize that confidence is something that comes from your own self-talk versus what other people are saying.
On the field against Notre Dame, the USC offense had a, I would say, up and down day. There were some things that just looked kind of sloppy. There were, you know, maybe misreads. There were drops. There, you know, Notre Dame overwhelmed the run game at certain times. Do you remember being surprised by how well the Notre Dame defense was playing? Do you remember thinking that your own offense seemed rattled by a moment that perhaps was bigger than they anticipated? Because this was not the USC offense that we had seen in big moments before.
Yeah, no, I can remember it like yesterday. I can remember halftime. You know, ever been in Notre Dame, the visitors' halftime locker room is probably the worst locker room I've ever seen, you know, in terms of college, right?
Yeah.
And I haven't been inside it in a couple of years, but it hasn't really changed. You know, it's kind of like your old school, like a bad gym locker in high school, like got a couple rows, and really no space to address the team. And we came in and we were very clear, and we were a second half team that whole year, right? Pete's real whole tenure, they were a second half program, right? Which is pretty much a detriment to every USC coach after him, because everybody just wants them to make changes like Pete made. It wasn't really about the quote unquote changes we made, but we were able to just kind of reset a lot of times at halftime and know exactly what worked. Sark and Lane, Sark specifically, was brilliant. I've never been around anybody ever that can see the game from the sideline like he can see the game from the sideline. I mean, he can tell what the defensive line is doing on the far side of the defensive line. It's fascinating to hear those guys operate. And that's where we were. We also knew we were going to get their best shot. You know, if you go back in time, guys, yeah, every team rocks the bus now, right? We started that the previous day. We got there Friday, and there was 10,000 fans for our walkthrough outside of Notre Dame Stadium. And we start rocking the bus, right? And then we see the grass, and it's X amount of inches higher than it usually is. And then for me, I played at Notre Dame a bunch at Pitt, and we lost every game like this game kind of shook out, in terms of you just kind of ran out of steam, and you hate to say it, it was like touchdown Jesus helped him out to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. Like, it just felt so real, because how many teams have gone into that stadium and played great and you lose late, right? That's kind of how Notre Dame has built their program, on a lot of like fourth quarter wins. So I kind of was feeling that. And I think our team, it went back to our confidence. They never flinched. Like, even when we were down, it was never, we're going to lose here, the streak ends. It was never, I don't feel as though our guys felt the burden of like, it kept getting bigger and heavier. Oh my God, the streak ends. I felt as though the pressure was on Notre Dame. Like, end this game. Let's end it. And you look at the last couple of drives of that game, and some moments, like, you know, Brady Quinn obviously plays, you know, out of his mind to a large degree. He makes that touchdown run. Mm-hmm. He's playing loose, but we knew parts of their team were playing tight. And I feel that looking back on it, I felt then that they were trying not to lose once they had the lead, versus us. We were saying, just give us another chance, man. We don't care how much time is left. Let's go.
How many times in the booth was the phrase, oh my God, thank God Reggie Bush plays for us. Oh my God. I mean, he has those two enormous touchdowns. He's a threat in the receiving game. Notre Dame has to account for him on every play. And this is a USC team that had run the ball really well all year long, was not, outside of Reggie and some of his longer runs, running the ball that well. Matt Leinart was not hitting receivers downfield. He had a big play to Dominique Bird. He had a couple big plays like in the intermediate range, but this was not the USC offense consistently like it had been earlier. Is it just, oh my God, thank God Reggie Bush is here?
There was a lot of that. I mean, I remember the run where he kind of hurdled a safety. Mm-hmm. And I remember watching that. I was like, it's a route. We're going to run these dudes out of the stadium. And our team felt that too. And I forget the safety's name. Who was the boxer?
Zbikowski.
Tom Zbikowski, yeah.
Tom Zbikowski. He played out of his mind. I remember he was all over the field in that game.
Return punt.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, those were the ones that, like, that's what killed us in that game. Like, you go back and, at least when we went back and watched it as a staff, it was the first time all year that year where throughout the game there were not a lot of plays, let alone drives, where we didn't have bus, you know, we didn't have unforced errors, what I would call them now as a broadcaster, you know. So the punt return, total bust, unforced error. We don't do that. Like, we hadn't done that. It was terrible. Like, we were moving the ball in the run game, but then we wouldn't make a block, or somebody would slip backside, you know, from a defensive end standpoint and track down the inside zone play. that's what was killing us all game. We just couldn't get out of our way. And of course, you got to give credit to Notre Dame. They had obviously a talented team in that regard. They were playing with incredible energy and confidence, and the crowd was epic and all this stuff. And that place, I know you guys have been there, but it's really cool because it literally feels like Cameron Indoor, maybe in basketball, like fans are literally on top of you. So I just think that's kind of how the game went. We never were able to put anything together for a long period of time in that ball game.
All right, Yogi, you mentioned the grass. You were there as part of the staff. I was there as a fan. And I remember walking out to my seat, looking at the field and thinking, what the hell is this? But surely somebody forgot to do their chores here. Walking through maybe the day before, walking out onto the field the day of, like, is there any reaction to that whatsoever? What did people say when they saw the length of the turf?
Oh, yeah. Well, it was the day before. It was the night before in the meeting. And, you know, it was kind of the old coaching adage of, cool, that might slow us down, but it's going to slow you down too, you know? And so we really didn't care. It was kind of like, and you know, you look back in that reign, that era of Coach Carroll, every team, Oklahoma, there's even quotes from Bob Stoops around this game where a lot of teams hoped things went their way. You know, they hoped that it rained. They hoped that the grass slowed Reggie down. They hoped that we turned the ball over. And the differences of hoping versus knowing are dramatic. I still say that now, like a fringe bowl team is still hoping things go well in fourth quarters of games. Clemson, Bama, certain teams, they know what they can do and who they are. And that's what we were. We're like, okay, cool. Like, you want to do that? You want to bring 10,000? You want to have Charlie Weiss run his mouth? Like, whatever it is, like, go ahead. Like, keep hoping that things go well, because we know that we're going to run ISO right up here. You know what? We know that Dwayne Jarrett won't get covered in single coverage. We know that our defense is going to bring pressure. You know, that was just the mindset. I don't want it to be felt as arrogance, but it was right on that edge. And that's where Pete was masterful. Like, he got us to play right on the edge. And that's why, you know, our team led the nation in penalties a lot of the time, or was one of the worst teams. Like, we played on an edge. Officials knew it. Opponents knew it. But it also allowed us to be as talented as we were. And that's the edge. I call it the edge of uncomfortable, is where greatness happens. And that's where our team was, because it was such a competitive environment.
So the game comes down to the final drive for each team, really. Notre Dame puts together an unbelievable drive. Brady Quinn, total gamer, leads them down the field. They take the lead, Notre Dame does. And then USC, with their backs against the wall, Matt Leinart comes to the line of scrimmage, checks into a play that, or checks into something that wasn't necessarily called down from the booth or from a headset on the sideline. What was that Matt Leinart play, and what was it supposed to be, and what did he, we know what he checked into, but what was the process involved in the biggest moment of that regular season?
Yeah, no, I can remember it like yesterday, man. It was cool. Like, I could remember Matt's eyes on the highlight film, and I've always, and I still believe this, Matt Leinart is the coolest guy I've ever met. No offense to either one of you. Like, he just
none taken
swag around
it's
him.
It's close to, like, 2-3. It's close to,
yeah,
and three.
Yeah, close to three. Close to three. But Matt's always had this aura about him, like that it factor, right? Where when you walk into a room, people feel you and you make them better. And he always did that. And I can remember the sequence, and I'll take you through it. So up in the booth, I'm next to Lane. My job at the time is to basically write down what play we run and then the coverage that is run in association with it. And the other guy sitting next to me, his job is to write down the defensive front. And if there's blitzes after the series, we give those pieces of paper to Lane, and he looks at what do they play against, what formation. We come up there now, and here it is, season on the line, right? Everybody knows it. And the play we call is 61. I believe it was Sam protection, Y option. And the play in the formation, I believe it was a 3-by-1 formation. And the option route is from your tight end, Dominique Bird. Dominique Bird, he could either take the option out, take the option in, or if there's no deep safety, you just run a go route. There was clearly a deep safety. And what Lane says to Sark, and Sark relays to Matt, is if they give us this certain look, check it to 80 to stay. and 82 stay sluggo, I think it was F win, was the audible that we often called. And it was old school West Coast offense, slant and go on the front side, or I guess it'd be on the back side. And then, basically sluggo win on the front side. So it's slant and go Dwayne Jarrett, seam route by the slot receiver, hitch way outside, and max protection by the tight end Dominic Byrd and the running back. And the running back, Reggie, could trickle out if he had to later. He trickled out on the previous snap, if you remember that, when he caught and made a nice little game. So we audible that, or we call 61 Y, we call the Y option play. And here's Lane next to me. And I'm like, not saying a word, obviously. You're just kind of watching. You see the coverage. You know what they need to see. And it's really this moment of zen amid chaos of Lane, Sark, Leinart. And they go, it's the look. It's the look. Have them change it. And Sark screams in that voice that you know, hey, 82 stay. And the signal is, I'm giving it to you now. I don't know if you can see
visually, me. Like, yeah, yeah. Holding wide binoculars.
Exactly. And it's out to the side. And he gives them that signal, and everybody relays it. And you hear Matt with his eye black left to the right, offensive line, tight end, everybody gets the signal. And it's single high. And we're like, okay, if his eyes can hold the safety, which was the whole point, if it's this single high defense, like we're gonna win. And they did. And DJ, Dwayne, obviously wins his release at the line of scrimmage. And for the first time in a long time, the football gods, if you believe in them, and I don't necessarily do all the time, but if you believe in them, they're on the side of the visitor in Notre Dame Stadium. And it goes right past or through the arms, of the DB, and Dwayne makes the catch. So we see it in the booth before it happens. He's got him. And then, and I hate to say it, but I had zero poise. No one had any poise because he caught it, and we are jumping up and down in the press box. Go, DJ, go. And remember, Lane coached the receivers, recruited Dwayne out of New Jersey, and we're thinking this is a house call walk-off. This is how you win the ball game. And as he's doing that, we're all celebrating. The papers that I referenced earlier are now everywhere. There's nothing. Like, it is a disaster. Notre Dame, because they're, you know, an old iconic stadium, maybe they have this old little TV up in the right, and I'm up there like fist pumping like I'm in Vegas, and I smash the television. And I felt like I broke it, but it didn't matter. Like, you just, it was next play, right? You're screaming, the adrenaline is insane. For me, I mean, I had an utter distaste for everything Notre Dame, because here I am like 12 months removed from playing, only wanted to go there, never beat him in my career as a player. We always lost close, as I referenced earlier. So I like instantly revert back to like the kid in college in a heartbeat. And then he gets hawked, and we're thinking, oh my God, it's chaos, right? And we sit back down, and like headsets are off, man. Like, this is not like, it's like organized chaos, right? Like, this is pandemonium in the booth, let alone the sideline. Like, you guys saw it, right? And there's the great YouTube viral clips that are out there all over, with everybody kind of running back and forth. And amid all of that, and I just talked about it on a Pac-12 YouTube series I'm doing about Coach Carroll, because it was one of his proudest moments when he looks back on his career, because he wasn't that way. He was straight, like, poised. And he always had trained himself that in the moments of chaos, he would be the calmest. And he was. And here we are trying to figure it out. What do we do? What don't we do? And I'll hit a period there, but that's basically what set up the next segment of plays.
So the next segment of plays is the Bush Push. The Bush Push is forever enshrined in the history of college football. Matt Leinart goes up to the line, acts as if he's going to stop the clock, because the clock was winding at that point in time. USC was out of timeouts. Instead of clocking the ball, decides to go forward, initially stopped on that first push. He kind of spins around. He's facing backwards towards Reggie Bush, and Reggie just gives him a shove and knocks him into the end zone. Alas, the Bush Push. What is the reaction like after that?
Well, got to remember, too, right prior to that, Leinart sneaks and kind of does like the whirly bird out of the sideline, and the clock runs out, and the fans rush the field, and they think the game's over. And again, Pete is straight poised, and it's set back up. And while that's happening, the headsets are still on. And Lane and Sark, again, they were just so dialed. And they're talking to Matt about what to do and what the play call is going to be. And we had an audible within that play call where, you know, you're signaling spike it, spike it, spike it. But if one of the coaches pointed at you, it basically gave you the option, like, hey, Matt, if you want to take it, take it. You know, and we would obviously all the trust in the world in Matt. And I'm sure you guys have heard this story from Matt's mouth. If not, it's a great story. He shared it. He shared it many times where he kind of just turns around and looks at Reggie and he goes, hey, let's do this. And that was kind of the relationship those two had, and, you know, everything that they'd been through and what we've been through. And Reggie was on his own Heisman run at the time. And away he goes. And you knew he was going to make it. Like, there was never a hesitation. You know, offensive line, when you look back at that offensive line, we're talking like Ryan Khalil, Sam Baker. I mean, there's the dudes of dudes on that line. Obviously, everybody kicked out to the NFL. And then Reggie wasn't going to allow it to happen. And you just kind of happened in slow motion, man. And when it happened, we lost our minds again in the booth. And all we wanted to do was get down there as fast as possible. And I'll never forget it because there's only two of these that I remember in my career. And one of them is this game. The other one's the Texas game that we lost. But you usually get escorted down by police, security, especially Notre Dame, because it's not like, I don't know what it is now for staffs, but it's not really set up for staffs to get back down to the booth or get down to the locker room very easily. Like, you basically have to like kind of run through the fans and find your way back to the tunnel and then work your way through the tunnel. I mean, it's chaos. And this game was bonkers. So we get out and there's people everywhere because people are pissed, right? Like, Notre Dame fans are leaving. Everybody's, you know, pushing, shouldn't it be? Nobody really knew the rule, I believe, in that era. Like, I don't think you guys watched the broadcast. I highly doubt they said, like, yeah, you're allowed to push, but you can't pull. Like that rule didn't even exist yet. Right. In college football. So there was a lot of debate about what went on, let alone should the game already have been over. So Notre Dame fans clearly are very upset in that regard. So it's Lane, Rocky Seto, myself, Dave Watson, Sam Otto. There's a couple of us that are like scurrying out. And I'm trying to still gather up all those papers. You know, you don't want to leave anything. Like, every coach is paranoid that like you leave all your secrets, even though everybody does the same thing for the most part. So I gather everything up, put it in our little briefcase, and you know, TV is pretty much a disaster up in the And we run our way down and get to the locker room as fast as possible because for as masterful as Pete was at so many things, he was such a great orator, and we wanted to hear what he was going to say. We wanted to celebrate with the fellas, and it was crazy, man. It was an ultimate exhale game of like, not of thank God it's over and we won. Most teams that are going for a natty, I think, feel that way. It was more of like, holy shit, that just happened. Like, can you believe? And it was almost that moment where I think Matt, maybe Reggie, definitely as a staff, we knew there was something special occurring, not just for that season, but in the big picture of collegiate athletics and college football. So yeah, it just felt like, hey man, this is our year. If we're going to win that game, like, we're going to win them all.
Yeah. And you know, Yogi, from the other side, being a fan in the stadium with a good friend of mine who was a USC fan, we had done plenty of trash talk leading up to that game, even throughout the game. But after that sequence, the last 2 minutes, again, like you said, totally bonkers. We walked out of that stadium and didn't say a word to each other for a good 20, 30 minutes because, again, we were still processing like, holy shit, this happened. We were here. We saw it with our own eyes. And total pandemonium in the stadium. Didn't quite know what was going on. The clock runs out. People run on the field. Did he score? Did he not score? What happened when Dwayne Jarrett caught the ball? How did he get open? Like, so many questions without the benefit of having the TV in front of you that we just didn't know how to react. It was an insane moment in sports.
It was out of control. And I thought it was also, you look back at moments in our careers now, like, it was great for the game. You know, and it's great when SC and Notre Dame are good, you know, and national conversation. And that year, you know, there's a lot of backstory there, right? Charlie Weiss and Pete Carroll kind of traded spots with the Patriots and the Jets and Parcells and their staffs. And I don't want to say there's bad blood there, but it wasn't like nobody was buddy-buddy in that regard. And Pete never made it personal, but you could feel it. to a degree. Like, there was just a lot of underlying dynamics, and, you know, Charlie gets the job, and I don't want to misquote him, but it was something along the lines of, we're going to have a decided schematic advantage, which clearly was ridiculous. But there's just a lot. There was just a lot going on. And then you add in the game and the programs and the history. And it was really a gift to be a part of, a small part of that team and that year. And as I get older, just that program, because it is different. It's way different than Alabama. It's Clemson, and what Dabo was doing is the closest thing to me at what Pete did. It's just obviously in a different conference and a completely different community.
Yogi Roth, thank you very much for your time. And I was sweating a little bit when you were talking about the audible ahead of the Dwayne Jarrett play. Like, what's going to happen? What is he still going to catch it? And he did. He totally did. And I appreciate that sort of insight, which unfortunately Ty in Section 104 could not provide the show.
Nope.
Anytime, fellas. I love what you're doing. Yeah, I love all your content. You know, I'm a big fan. I should have worn my T-shirt today. I do love my Solid Verbal tee. I appreciate those. I wasn't thinking that.
Soft material only. That's how I live, and that's how the Solid Verballers live.
I love it. Well, stay safe. Thanks for having me.
Take care, man.
Thank you.
All right, Dan. Well, there you go. Cool stories. Cool insight from our friend Yogi Roth from the Pac-12 Network. This has been fun. We're going to have to do more of these. You get to pick the next game.
I'll do a heartbreaking Oregon loss.
Okay.
If the first two episodes are going to be Ty makes peace with an old wound, I will make peace in the same way with an old Oregon wound.
So here's the deal. You know how to find us. Subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We will be here. We will be with you all throughout the quarantine and forevermore.
Mm-hmm.
You can also follow us on Twitter, on Instagram, and on Facebook. Check out the subreddit as well. You can find all of our old stuff at solidverbal.com. And if you got anything to send us via email, it's solidverbal@gmail.com, Dan.
Yeah. And if you're using Zoom or Skype or any sort of video conferencing service for your work while you're at home, this is just a reminder. Sit in front of a window. Get some natural light on you.
Get some natural light.
Treat your video professionally. That's all.
All right, Dan. Well, this has been fun.
Agree. I can't wait to do this again. I really hope we have football this fall.
That would be nice. For that guy over there, my good friend, Dan Rubenstein, hold up in New York City. For myself, Ty Hildenbrandt, here in Eastern Pennsylvania. Thank you so much for embarking on this journey with us. We will be back in a week. In the meantime, stay safe, stay solid, and we'll catch you soon.
Peace. And Ty, play the little song for me.
Oh, yeah. So that really is John Tesh, huh?
Really John Tesh.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.